The call to order this meeting of the House Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from the 23rd of January. I wonder if Chair Cleavorn would make a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Thank you. Chair Cleavorn moves approval of the minutes from January 23rd, 2023. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Our first bill on the agenda is House File 390 from Chair Akam. Welcome to the Commerce Committee. As you make your way and make yourself comfortable, I will move House File 390 be recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And with that motion before us, Representative Akam, to your bill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and present House File 390. So 390 is a patient-focused bill that is designed to ensure complete breast cancer screening that promotes early diagnosis and ultimately saves lives. Here's what we know. 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in their lives. And in fact, it's the most common form of cancer in women. And we also know that breast cancer is not just limited to women and that many men are diagnosed with it as well. Treatment and survival rates for breast cancer have advanced over the last many decades and in large part due to early diagnosis. The importance of early detection is reflected in the requirement by the Affordable Care Act to include breast cancer screening as an essential health benefit at no cost to patients. The goal of this federal provision is to increase early detection, lower cancer treatment costs, and save lives. The only problem is that for a small percentage of patients, an initial mammogram is inconclusive. It doesn't say there is a problem, and it doesn't say there isn't. Those patients need additional testing to determine if they need to be concerned or not. Those additional tests can and often do come with large copays to patients that can range from several hundred dollars up to $1,000. These large copays become a barrier to care and potentially delay in diagnosis, which we know can negatively impact survival rates of breast cancer. In fact, treating advanced cancer is often much more expensive, coupled with reduced rates of survival. As a breast cancer survivor myself, I know firsthand how important early diagnosis is, and I want to ensure that all patients have that opportunity for the same positive outcomes that I had. And so for those of you that were on the committee last year, you may remember when this bill came that there was a Department of Commerce analysis that looked into the bill to determine whether it was a mandate or not. And the Department of Commerce did determine that, in fact, it was not a new mandate and that it was actually a clarification of existing benefits.
And just to interject, that is in committee members' packets.
Wonderful.
So if committee members want to see that, that analysis is in your packets.
Great. Glad to hear that. And in that report, it was determined that the potential of harm from this bill is low and the potential of benefit is to be moderate, and that's due to the early diagnosis. And so I do have a couple of testifiers, and I also just want to point out that yesterday there was the bankers reached out with some concerns about the potential impact with this bill and healthcare or health savings accounts. And so recognizing that there might be something there, I would love it if the Department of Commerce can potentially work with them. I spoke with the department yesterday. They said they would talk, and this isn't the final leg on this journey. And so we can look into that. The department can work with the bankers to see how we can rectify that, if in fact there is. There was some discrepancy as to whether or not there really was an issue.
I'm looking around the room, and I'm not seeing anyone from the department here right now.
Helen Bassett right
oh,
here.
Oh, there you go. I'm sorry, looking over you, and I'm sure the department is willing to engage with you on that, and we're getting a nod, so.
Yes, great. And then with that, I do have a couple of testifiers, if that would be, if now would be the appropriate time.
It would be the appropriate time. I see that we have Shaniqua James. You come forward, say your name for the record, and proceed your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the members of this committee. My name is Shaniqua James, and I am a clinical social worker and also the program director for Gilda's Club Twin Cities. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, just want to make sure I'm not yelling into the mic.
So
for those of you who are not familiar, Gilda's Club is a local nonprofit that serves people who are impacted by cancer. We offer free social and emotional support, so healthy lifestyle classes like cooking, yoga, and then also weekly support groups for those impacted by cancer. And although Gilda serves people with all cancers, a large number of our members have a diagnosis of breast cancer. I have heard many stories about the barriers in regards to testing, diagnostic testing specifically, for getting the diagnosis of breast cancer, which delays cancer treatment and then also can result in mortality. So I'm going to tell you a specific story about a member who we'll call Tina, which is actually the name of my mother who died from breast cancer. Tina shared her story about how her original diagnosis of breast cancer was delayed because she could not afford to get the recommended follow-up testing after she had the original mammogram. This was a preventable delay that led to Tina's late diagnosis and delayed cancer treatment. Another member, who I'll refer to as Janice, who is my grandmother, who also passed from breast cancer, had a similar story where her treatment was delayed and also she could not afford to pay for the testing following her original mammogram that came up abnormal. That led to her having to sell her home and move in with her children in order to afford her medical bills and ultimately pay for her recovery and her treatments. The commonality in both of these stories is how the costs associated with diagnostic services and testing snowballed into a health and financial crisis for those who are most impacted. In addition, this lack of coverage for those services create a disparity within minority communities who have a higher risk of mortality and late diagnoses. In addition to that, it's also a burden to those in our rural communities who have also a barrier for health equity and access to these testings. So this bill has the potential to aid in eliminating these health disparities by increasing the accessibility with covering these costs and allowing the Tinas and the Janices of Minnesota to focus on their cancer journey and recovery instead of the burden of paying for their treatments. I truly believe that is the duty of all of us to ensure that these individuals who are already facing stressful and life-changing circumstance are not burdened with making the decision to either pay for services or pay for their treatment or, you know, being able to pay for their lives. This is no decision that any Minnesotan should have to face. I urge the members of this committee to pass this important legislation to begin to close the disparity gap and make healthcare services more accessible. Again, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony and for sharing your family story with us. I really appreciate that. Thank you. Next testifier is Amy Koch. You come forward and state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't often get to testify in front of the House. I'm a little nervous.
Rightfully
we're okay.
So.
We don't hurt. Oh.
Patty's being, that's not true.
You don't.
Hey, now.
Way better than the Senate.
Yeah. Oh. We agree.
So ugly already. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time today. My name is Amy Koch, and I'm here to testify on behalf of Susan G. Komen in support of House File 390 and also on behalf of myself. My Aunt Laura tells a story of visiting with my great-grandmother. And when they were getting ready one morning, she noticed that her grandmother had deep scars across her chest. And she asked her, as kids will, well, Grandma, what happened? And her grandmother, my great-grandmother, said, that's so I can spend more time with you. And that was the only explanation given. Well, my great-grandmother couldn't have known how deep those scars would run, because those same scars were on her daughter, my grandmother, when she passed away. They were on her granddaughter, my mother, who passed away at 64 on June 17th, 2012. And those same scars are on her great-granddaughter, my sister Natasha, who's had a double mastectomy, and to this point is winning the fight, finally, and maybe ending those scars. So, about estimated 16% of women screened with modern digital mammography will require follow-up imaging. House File 390 ensures that those women will have the required diagnostic screening covered. Family histories, anomalies, dense breast tissue, and a previous bout with breast cancer are all reasons that you might have to do additional screening. Screening for breast cancer is tricky because dense breast tissue, which happens to be a reason and seems to be associated with additional risk for breast cancer, is tricky in these initial screenings. Fatty tissue shows up as dark on a mammography, but dense breast tissue, like in my family, shows up white. And unfortunately, the other thing that shows up white on a mammography is tumors. And so that screening, the additional screening, is absolutely imperative for us. The Department of Commerce, as you've heard, has evaluated the language in this bill, and they stated very clearly that this is not to be considered a new mandate, but simply clarifies existing benefits under health plans. 2 years ago, I had an abnormal initial screening, which was my second. My family history and dense tissue required diagnostic screening. After the ultrasound, I received a bill for over $800. I called my insurance company thinking that something must have been wrongfully billed or not covered because screening is supposed to be covered. I was told I only get the initial mammogram. Now, for me, this was a surprise, an annoyance, and frankly, expensive. But for many women that cannot afford the additional expense and they may forego this imperative, important screening. I have seen the costs and the devastation associated with missed detection up close and personal. The tens of thousands of dollars that were spent on my mom's double mastectomy, followed by thousands on chemo and radiation, more thousands for her second round of chemo and radiation because it had moved to her lymph nodes, more and thousands more for the brain scans and the appointment where the doctor told me your mom's brain is full of cancer, the money spent on hospice nurses, the bed, the equipment, the every other day delivery of bags of pain medication because my mom couldn't speak and I had to ensure that she had enough medicine that she was not suffering. All of this is far offset by some initial screenings. My sister Natasha is winning this fight because of her early detection. She got the additional screenings, and she's alive and will live, we hope, to see her elementary school kids get married and have babies of their own. Early detection saves medical costs. Early detection saves pain and suffering, and early detection saves lives. I would ask you to please, thank you, Representative Akam, for this bill. Please support House File 390 and help more people spend more time with the people they love.
Well, thank you very much for that testimony, and thank you also for sharing your personal story. And I think the whole committee is really glad to hear that your sister is doing well. That's great news. I think that's the end of your author's testifiers, if I'm correct. So we did have one member of the public sign up in advance, and that's Dan Andreessen from the Council of Health Plans. Mr. Andreessen, if you want to come forward, put your name in for the record, and proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. So my testimony today will be focused on operationally how this would work if enacted. First of all, just kind of level set, making sure that everyone knows the plans that will be impacted by this. In your packet is this letter. Using a pie chart that we used in committee a couple of weeks ago regarding the markets that this will fall onto. So it is the state public programs, the commercial market in terms of the individual and small and large group markets, and then the state employee program. This won't apply to the employer-based self-insured market. Second, because there's no language in the bill that requires the costs from providers to be lowered for these services, and assuming that those costs stay the same, then these costs will need to be moved to somewhere else. So in terms of the small and large group market, or maybe the SIGA program, that cost will probably be moved to premiums. For the individual market, this will probably come into play with cost-sharing shifts. So also in your packet, there's a table that lists the different plan categories that plans have to adhere to. These are federal regulations. For products that go on the individual market have to fall into one of these four categories that are defined by a ratio of premiums to cost sharing. So, for example, the bronze level plans are 60% premiums, 40% cost sharing. So if we take this out of that 40%, in order to meet federal requirements, we're going to have to increase cost sharing somewhere else. A couple questions on the bill. So we're looking for some clarification as to what services would fall under this bill. Right now it just says additional diagnostic services, which could be pretty broad. It could be additional mammograms, could be biopsies, pathology, maybe more. So we'd just like to get some clarification as to what that would be, just so once this gets coded between us and providers, there's no confusion or misunderstanding as to what falls into this. Also, the effective date of 2024 will be difficult because of the cycle of plan approvals, and happy to talk to Representative Akin about that as the bill moves forward. And then lastly, I just want to address some statements that have been made in letters that have been presented to the committee, namely the statement from letter from Reyes Radiology, where their statement reads, "More than ever, we must work to eliminate all barriers to care, and a patient's inability to pay should not prevent them from obtaining a potential life-saving and cost-saving early diagnosis." We completely agree with the statement. Cost should not be a barrier to getting care. And if the author of this letter believes that, and that the clients are having a hard time paying for their services, the simple solution is for them to lower the prices that they're charging. Costs associated with insurance, both premiums and cost sharing, is a correlation to the direct correlation to the cost of healthcare. And in this case, the cost sharing is what it is because of what Reyes Radiology's other providers are charging for their care when it comes to mammograms, MRIs, CT scans, and others, which can be thousands of dollars. So it's unfortunate that their statement doesn't really acknowledge their role in this problem of affordability or offer their solutions. They just focus on insurance companies and how products are being designed to help our enrollees afford their costs for what they're billing. So hopefully we'll see some changes as this bill moves forward. Stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Andreessen. That was the only member of the public who signed up to testify. Are there any other people wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member questions and discussions. Representative Tabke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Representative Akin, thank you for bringing this forward. We had in 2020, I was going to bring up issue and just confirm some things, but Amy Koch handled that for me, so I don't need to talk too much about dense breast tissue, but just thank you very much for having that as part of this. I have a constituent who has been struggling with this for quite some time, and it's a major issue, and I just appreciate your time and work to have that included, so thank you.
Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Akin, thank you very much for your persistence on this bill. I know that you keep bringing it back, and it's great. And I think that this really, I just wanted to speak to sort of bring up the larger problem that it does illustrate, right?
Mm-hmm.
I've been told the highest out-of-pocket costs in the nation in this state. And, you know, this is a really good illustration of what that means to health care. That people have insurance and they can't get care. And it's just such a great illustration of that, both on the human level and on the cost level, mm-hmm. as has been really mentioned. So, and I also just wanted to say, I mean, the Council of Health Plans is not wrong also to bring up the point about cost of care. And obviously there's no silver bullet solution to all of this, but I think Mr. Andreessen did mention our public programs and so on. Well, I'm bringing back the bill to, or somebody will for me, to get rid of the out-of-pocket costs in our public programs. And I think we must address that problem just broadly, that, you know, when people buy a health insurance product, they, I think, reasonably expect that they now have access to care they need, and yet they don't. And, you know, this lovely term cost sharing, which makes you think of sitting down and splitting lunch with your friend, that's not what this is. This is cost, this is barriers to care, cost barriers to care. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to thank you, and I hope we can get this across the finish line this year, and look forward to hearing it in the Health Committee, too.
Thank you. Yes. May I respond?
Yes. Representative Akam.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate those comments, Chair Liebling. And what I will say about the cost of care and the cost sharing of this particular bill, breast cancer screening is a part of the essential health benefits because it's shown to, with early diagnosis, prevent larger costs down the road. So while I appreciate there's, cost sharing differences on the copay part of it, but ultimately it's going to save costs on the larger scale. So we can't forget to look at the forest for the trees, and instead of just focusing on that one particular detail, we need to see the bigger picture.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps, well, Representative Akam, I'm wondering if there is, if we'll be able to see a fiscal note on this.
It's been requested. I'm sorry, Mr.
It's
Chair.
Okay.
thank you. It has been requested. And so we don't have one yet, but it will be soon.
Thank you.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question, Mr. Chair, then, and I don't know if you've ever, I haven't seen a single fiscal note in a single committee yet. And I don't know if you, as the majority, have been informed on what's happening on that front, if these are going to start coming. But I'm really concerned that we're seeing a ton of bills come through committees and we're not seeing any fiscal notes. And we're passing them out of committees of jurisdiction over those fiscal notes. And we have no idea what the costs of these will be. Have you heard anything?
Well, I'm surprised to hear you say that you haven't seen any fiscal notes in any committees, because multiple of my bills have fiscal notes, and I've seen fiscal notes on bills and other committees as well. I just had a hearing in Chair Akam's committee yesterday where we had a fiscal note on the bill. As to this bill in this committee, I just having seen this bill before and bills like it, I can pretty much guarantee there will not be a fiscal note that gives a cost to the Department of Commerce. The cost, if any, would be to
CGIP.
To CGIP, and which is not within this committee's jurisdiction. Oh. That's why I'm comfortable having a hearing on this bill. It's also true that, you know, to the extent that we're going to pay for anything out of our committee's budget, we're going to do that in a budget bill later on, and so we would have a hearing on the budget bill at that time with the fiscal note. So sometimes, you know, I'll be sending bills out so they can hit other committee stops so we can get maximum impact, with the idea that if we're going to pay for something, it's going to be in our budget, and we're going to talk about that at that time. So I hope that answers your question, Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And yes, I appreciate that perspective, that if it's going to have a cost within your jurisdiction, you will make sure you see a fiscal note. So I hope we see a fiscal note on this in health before we do anything with it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not exactly sure who this first question should go to, and maybe the department in their analysis can enlighten the committee and the public on this. So we have our the first round of mammograms. We've got some concerns. We're going to have that second round. What's the percentage of persons, and maybe the plans can help us with this, that we would have? So if you have 100% of people going in, is it 5% that have the let's take a pause and let's look at that at the next level, or is it 10% or is it 20%?
I think
Representative Akam. Yeah, if you know who you'd like to direct that question to, or if you have an answer.
Well, I will say thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative O'Driscoll. I think in the Susan G. Komen letter, they talked about it being 16% of patients that are sent back for follow-up, that it's an inconclusive test and sent back for follow-up. So that's the statistic I have. I am not a mammography expert, but that's the numbers that I've been told. And I think in the Commerce report, it did talk about it in much more general terms. It didn't have specific numbers.
Representative Rogers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that's important to be able to get out there for the consideration of the committee and also for the public's edification as well. Did I just say edification? Oh, my goodness. But my next set of questions is, Mr. Andreessen can come back. I'd just like to do some follow-up with him if I could. Mr. Andreessen, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No, Representative Driscoll, continue.
Thank you. Mr. Andreessen, I know I'm very respectful of the time frame and the need to get the analysis done for determining premiums for the upcoming year and just how painstaking that is with actuaries and collecting data and what have you. You testified earlier that you're in that process right now. When would be a good time, not specifically for this particular item, but when you would need to know to be able to actually account for? Can you give us a timeline so that we aren't bringing things to you at the last minute, so to speak, because we have these deadlines that are set by the legislature that you have to get things to Commerce and different folks. And so I don't want to disadvantage you, because I don't want to disadvantage the people in the state of Minnesota from potentially receiving care that they do and want and actually need.
And so, Mr. Andreessen, with the context to Representative Driscoll's excellent question, is the bill has effective dates of January 1, 2024. So if you could answer the question, including that context, that would be helpful.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, so to your question is when, it's kind of before January. So with an effective date of 1/1/24, that means for plan year 24, this would apply to all plans being sold after that date. So right now, plans are actually working on their 2024 products, putting those together, and probably by the time this would become law, we would have already sent our plans into Commerce for their initial review. So probably 2025 would be the better date for this, because that's, once the review gets done, rates get published for final in October, right then that's when they start working on 2025.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Andreessen, a follow-up to that idea. So in an ideal world, not specifically this, again, in an ideal world, what should we do? And I'm going to put this into context, because this committee worked very hard last year on a bipartisan approach with the Senate at that time to put together requests that people would bring forward for mandatory coverage to be put in place. And it was kind of a, timeout so that we can get an evaluation, and Commerce is bringing those. So I also realize that that can add some timeline into here. When do you believe that it's most realistic for pricing, premiums, evaluation, need, plans, et cetera, the stuff that you would need, that this should actually be going into effect? Is 24 reasonable, or this be something that would be a 25? Again, I ask two tiers of questions, the original timeline, and then how do we address this that's before us right now?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, probably having it effective toward the 2025 plan year would make the most sense, because right now they are going through that process. They are submitting their rates soon. And so with this bill, which with it shifting the cost, especially for individual market plans, which that's what Commerce is going to oversee, they would need that extra time to gather that data and see how the money is all going to flow. So 1/1/25 would work out better. 2024, as it is written now, is going to be a huge challenge.
Representative Driscoll.
So, Mr. Chair, the question on the table becomes, if the plans are able to implement this on 1/1/25, does it make sense we have a conversation about maybe doing an oral amendment to change the data on that at this point to try to accomplish that and keep everybody going the same direction? And again, I just want to underscore the fact that we now have this process where we're going to be looking at expanding or mandating coverages that we just put in place last year, that Commerce reviews these and comes back with some information. I think that helps us all to be able to determine what kind of coverage is, what's the cost and the benefit of those kinds of things. And I think that we maybe kind of have some gap things, and this might be one of those kinds of things. I'm just curious, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. I would not really want to entertain an oral amendment of that nature for two reasons. One is that I think that's a little bit more substantive than the technical way that we usually consider oral amendments. But the second reason, and actually I'll add a third reason. The second reason is that there are three different places in the bill that have effective dates. And I think when you have an oral amendment, it's best suited for a really specific small spot so that there's clarity both in the room but also in terms of what we're asking the reviser to do. And the fact that that would be in multiple locations in the bill gives me some pause. And then the third reason why I would not really want to entertain an oral amendment is that the bill does have another committee stop in the health committee where that issue could be considered. And I think there's pretty substantial overlap between those committees among the membership in this room, I think on both sides of the aisle. So I think that that change could be considered in the health committee rather than doing an oral amendment today, which could cause some problems for our overburdened revisor anyway. So I don't think I would entertain that kind of an oral amendment today. Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you are correct. I believe one of the leads on the health committee is here and one of the chairs from the health committee is also on this committee. So I would put them both on notice that we'll probably see something coming up soon in the way of some amendments at the chair's suggestion about how to resolve this, perhaps in the health committee instead of the commerce committee.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Andreessen, if you'll please stay seated. So cost-benefit is always in the eye of the beholder, right? So I'm wondering what, Mr. Chair, is it all right if I proceed? I forgot to ask. Wait,
yeah, please, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm wondering if your plan members have, if their actuaries have put together an estimate of what they believe they will save in the plan year 2024 by postponing this by a year.
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleburne, I'm trying to, so are you asking, have they done an analysis of
what this will cost them if it goes through this year as opposed to what it will cost them if it's delayed a year?
No, they have not. So at this point, they're just operating that, you know, current law is current law. There is the mandate review process that this bill went through last year.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some information on there that maybe plans would have submitted in terms of questions that were asked of them. But there wasn't necessarily an analysis that I have that I can answer that question.
Okay.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the next question I would have is, do your actuaries have some sort of data about how many people are diagnosed at stage 2 or stage 3 where this early detection might prevent some of those stage 3s?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleburne, they may have some historical data to kind of just how they've seen their patients over time. So I'd have to get that to you if that's something you would like. Each plan is a little bit differently. I don't have access to some of the individual data. But some of this kind of falls into whether it's considered preventative or diagnostic. And I think that's where some of this rub is that preventative services are no cost. There is no cost sharing on that. Whether this falls into the diagnostic, that's kind of when we start getting into cost sharing potentially being levied.
Okay, so thank you. So you're not, okay, that's a really important distinction, diagnostic versus preventative. So if this bill were to refer to this as preventative care, the supplemental mammogram or ultrasound or whatever the doctor prescribes, then you would have no opposition. But because it's classified as diagnostic, you have opposition. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
Mr. Andreessen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cleburne, it's not necessarily that. It's that if the way that it's written, it doesn't really define a specific procedure. And so typically, an additional mammogram, you don't pay out of pocket for that. It's just premium dollars being paid for that. You get one a year. If you need an additional one, then there may be cost sharing for that. Now, with the way the bill's written, it doesn't say additional mammogram. It just says additional diagnostic services, which could be almost anything. And there is no boundary to it. You could go in, get a biopsy. They do pathology. They may find, well, we need to do an additional scan or MRI because we're worried that the cancer has spread. So at what point does that now no longer become preventative cancer screening and become more of a diagnostic test?
So,
and Representative Cleaver,
yeah, I know you've got time.
One more follow-up. I do want to kind of move to a vote here soon, but
that's okay. I would really appreciate having that information about stage two and stage three, and I would also like to know if there is actuarial data. I'd like to see that as well, so that we have a better idea of the scope of it. And then, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Cleaver. I don't have any other members wishing to be recognized, so Representative Akam, I'll give you the final word.
I just thank you for the time being here with you today. I appreciate the consideration, and I ask for your support of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Akam. I will renew my motion that House File 390 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 390 is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. Thank you, Representative Akam. The next bill on our agenda is House File 290 from Chair and Cagle. And Representative Cagle, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would like to move House File 290 to the General Register.
Representative Cagle moves House File 290 be recommended to be placed on the General Register, and I understand you have an author's amendment, the DE2. Would you like to move your amendment?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cagle moves the DE2 amendment. Representative Cagle, could you briefly describe the amendment?
Yes, so thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 290 is a rate cap on payday lending. I'll quick do a walkthrough, and then if there's any specific questions, I have my phone-a-friend here. And then, so Section 1, there's just a technical change, deleting one of the statute number. Section 2 sets the annual interest rate at 30, or Section 2 defines the annual interest rate. Then Section 3 sets the percentage cap at 36%. Section 4 of the amendment makes it so that lenders can't skirt the system. And so we're really just trying to make sure that there's no cheating going on, no evasion. Section 5 is just another way of making sure that we don't get cheaters. And so that changes some of the credit limits and the days of the loan as well to kind of reflect inflation and all that kind of good stuff. And then basically the rest of it is just kind of is making sure that we're covering our bases and making sure that the 36% rate cap applies to not only the 47.6, but 47.601.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Any discussion to the DE2 amendment? Representative New.
Quick question. Now, we frankly, and I apologize, but we just got this less than 2 hours ago, so I have not been able to, I have not had time to really review this. But you, as you were going through, you said Section 1 deletes something. I don't see anything deleted. I only see language added in Section 1. Can you go over that again, please?
Representative Cagle.
Mr. Chair, Representative New on lines 1.5, there's just a deletion of 47.6.
Representative New.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion to the DE2? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the DE2 is adopted. Representative Cagle, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Payday loans are short-term loans, often less than $500 with hefty finance charges. Payday loans allow consumers to borrow against an anticipated paycheck or other anticipated earnings. And although payday loans may be marketed as one-time only emergency assistance, the loans are really designed to keep they're the one-time only loans to help get customers by until the next paycheck. Some customers who take out payday loans find themselves in a trap. They're trapped in a downward spiral of debt as they take out a series of loans one after the other. occurring greater and greater financial charges that can quickly exceed the amount borrowed. Payday lenders survived by keeping customers caught in this long-term debt. And before 2007, members of the American military service were not off limits. In fact, payday loan store clustered around military bases, promising quick cash to military families in need, who, when they borrowed from a payday lender, more often than not ended up getting caught in a triple-digit interest cycle. Congress acted to protect military families from this predation by including measures in the Defense Authorization Act of 2006 that prohibits payday lending to from charging higher than 36% APR. The lawmakers responding to a 92-page report from the Department of Defense documenting widespread and ongoing financial difficulties among military families due to predatory practices like payday lending. Predatory lending undermines military readiness, harms the morale of troops and their families, and adds to the cost of fielding an all-volunteer fighting force. So the report outlined the prevalence around military installations and payday lenders of overt marketing and sometimes installment and internet lenders. And these products, they provide our primary concern. So my question is, you know, why aren't all Minnesotans protected from these predatory lending practices? Often while they're marketed as quick fixes for an economic emergency, the average payday borrower in Minnesota takes over 9 loans per year. And that debt trap is not a bug in the system, but actually a feature of the industry. 75% of payday lenders, 75% of payday lenders' revenue each year comes from customers who are stuck in 10 or more, or who are stuck in 10 or more loans a year. And the military and Lending Act was signed into law by President George W. Bush, and since that time, 16 states and D.C. have extended that same 36% rate cap on payday loans, protecting their residents and protecting consumers from exorbitant interest rates and fees. And in 2016, South Dakota had a rate cap initiative on its November ballot, and it passed with 76% support, greater than the 61.5%. Percent that President Trump received in that state. And so voters in Montana, Ohio, Arizona, and Colorado have passed similar measures. And so I'm really hoping that that this will be the year that we can get it done here for Minnesota. And with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers. I have Ann Leland Clark, Vienna Wilson, Ryan Hamilton, and Patrick Kessler will be joining us. And my phone a friend here is Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid.
Wonderful. Well, we can start with Ann Leland Clark. If you want to step forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ann Leland Clark. I serve as the executive director of Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending is a statewide nonprofit with a mission to get families out of the predatory debt cycle by refinancing up to $1,500 of payday, auto title, online installment, pawn, and other loans carrying an average interest of 311%. Since we opened our doors in 2015 and began lending, we've reached nearly 600 Minnesotans across 38 counties in Minnesota and refinanced more than 814 predatory loans described. We've saved the community nearly $1.6 million that otherwise would have been drained in interest and fees had we not gotten them out of the trap. This $1.6 million that we've saved in our work pales into comparison to the $46 million that has been stripped in interest and fees since we began analyzing Department of Commerce reports by predatory lenders in 2016. This is sort of payday lenders' annual reporting to the Department of Commerce. So I'm here today to lift the stories and voices of the Minnesota families who have been very intentionally exploited by payday and other short-term small-dollar lenders. I'm here today with my board chair, Vienna, who will share her own sort of experience with how payday lending has impacted her community throughout her life. One thing I will say, a common theme that arises in the stories we hear is that turning to a payday loan is often a rational and a resourceful choice to a financial crisis, a financial trauma, or a shortfall, like paying rent, a car repair, a medical bill. However, this solution that provides immediate relief results in deeper and longer financial crises. And it's with a business model that literally banks on an individual's failure to repay, as you heard. This is just simply not fair lending. It is no coincidence nor mistake that these lenders are concentrated in and around low-income communities and communities of color. It is a business model that profits off of generational exploitation and the financial trauma that has been caused by a legacy of systemic and structural inequities in our consumer financial system. It is time we put an end to the business models designed around entrapment and wealth stripping and direct our communities, rather, to participate in the mainstream credit economy through equitable lending alternatives that are designed to protect and build wealth. More and more credit unions, you'll hear from one today, and banks are offering small dollar short-term lending solutions, as well as Minnesota's robust network of 35 plus CDFIs, community development financial institutions, with a mission dedicated to the common goal of expanding economic opportunity in low-income areas, and they're across the state of Minnesota. In fact, just 2 years ago, our own Department of Treasury in the U.S. launched the Small Dollar Loan Program that was created specifically to help these CDFIs across the nation and in Minnesota address the issue of expanding consumer access to mainstream financial institutions and directly provide alternatives to high-cost small dollar loans. Several of our Minnesota CDFIs received this award to design these small dollar loans. So, as you heard Representative Cagle describe, it is time we follow the actions of our own U.S. Department of Defense in 2006 when they passed the Bipartisan Military Lending Act, and then the 18 states in D.C., and in fact our own city of Moorhead, Minnesota, who passed a rate cap and followed suit in 2020. Thank you for the opportunity to share our work and support of House File 290.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll?
Just an inquiry about timing on this.
Sure.
I know we have a couple of bills, and being the lateness of this DE amendment coming over the lunch hour and stuff, I know that my members have a series of questions that they like to ask. I'm hoping that we have ample time available today to be able to do that. I know that sometimes you limit testimony. I'm just not telling you how to run the committee, but I'm suggesting that we do have questions that we have, and we can either have it here or on the House floor, since this is going lightning speed through this committee, it looks like, with no other stops, unless you're planning on laying it over for further consideration for members.
I am not planning on laying it over. I certainly will. I appreciate the guidance that your members have a lot of questions, and we will try to ask testifiers to be brief in their remarks to allow time for that. I do want to just say I don't agree that this is lightning speed. This bill has been around forever, and I mean, I've heard it in this committee many times, and we've had a lot of discussion about it. We're devoting as much of this hearing as we need to have a good discussion about it, as no other committee stops. But I don't think we're proceeding deliberately with good speed. But I don't know about lightning speed. Representative O'Driscoll, looks like you want to.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that may well be the case. You have the benefit of being in your third term here and having heard this on this committee. But well over a third of these people that are on this committee are brand new to the legislature, and many of them are brand new to this committee. So I'm just trying to do good committee work in committee, which we oftentimes hear is the place to do committee work. I won't delay any more time, but I want to get on the record with our concerns.
Understood. We will go to Ms. Wilson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Vienna Wilson. I'm the board chair for Exodus Lending, and in my day job, I work for the Metropolitan Council at the Metro Mobility Service Center. I came to Exodus Lending through a former colleague who was a board member at Exodus, and I first thought that there was no way that an organization like Exodus exists that actually cares about the financial well-being of people and will refinance a loan for 0% interest. I knew that I wanted to help in any way that I can. When that colleague's board term came up, I stepped into the role in 2020. I grew up in the Midway neighborhood in St. Paul, blocks away from both an Ace Cash Express and a Pan America, and witnessed the daily rotation of people going in and out. I even remember having checks cashed there in my younger years, and the incredibly high fees that they would charge for that service, let alone payday loans. These lenders make it their mission to target people who don't have access to a bank account or who don't have access to a traditional loan, and they take their hard-earned money. It's theft and entrapment.
underserved communities already go through enough, and the last thing that they need is to be directly targeted by a form of legal loan sharking. They plant themselves in areas and communities where they know that they will be surrounded by marginalized and low-income people who eventually will have no other choice but to fall into their trap when they will inevitably have a financial emergency. I have seen people outside of Ace Cash Express in tears. I have family members who have had to file bankruptcy because of these lenders. I've seen people have payday loans opened in their name through fraud because of their incredibly lax underwriting. I've seen young people who don't know any better trash their credit before they even get a start. I even see clients today in my job at Metro Mobility who are stressed out about getting a ride to a payday lender to refinance their loan. And I want to reiterate that these are elderly and differently abled individuals who are terrified about what's going to happen if they're not able to refinance their loan. This is why I support House File 290 and a 36% interest rate cap. 36% is already a very high interest rate. These lenders could easily make a profit charging people with an interest rate of 36%. The only reason that they pack their bags and leave every state that passes a rate cap is because their entire point of their business model is to be predatory. The entire point is to trap communities in an endless cycle that lines their pockets every 2 weeks over and over again. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Christina Volkers, the city administrator for the city of Oakdale. Ms. Volkers, if you want to come down and state your name for the record. And we're not going to time or anything, but if you try to limit your remarks to 2 or 3
very minutes. Very good. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm not Christina Volkers, but my name is Ann Finn, and I'm representing the League of Minnesota Cities. Ms. Volkers was unable to be with us today, but she is the Oakdale City Administrator and one of the League of Minnesota Cities board members. The League and our 837 members support this bill. We thank Representative Cagle for bringing it forward. We believe that the types of loans that are addressed in this bill are predatory in nature. They target vulnerable members of our communities, including minorities, the poor, elderly, and undereducated individuals. And the secondary issue is about local economies. Capital that would be circulated within communities to local businesses, perhaps owned by local residents, are diverted to these predatory businesses, and we think that's a problem. So I will stop there in light of the time, and thank you and urge your support for this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Dan Johnson from Arise Community Credit Union. If you can come forward, state your name for the record, proceed your testimony. And so I think you probably heard me say a minute ago, I'm not going to time you or anything, but if you could try to limit your testimony, absolutely, I would appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and members. My name is Dan Johnson, and I'm the CEO designee for Arise Credit Union. We stand in support of the House File 290. Arise Community Credit Union's goal is to create a financial hub of culturally responsive community cooperative economic system, delivering economically priced financial resources to build and sustain a resilient, financially healthy, and empowered community. That's pretty much what we want to do. We want to bring banking to the unbanked and some reasonable financial products, reasonably priced, I should say. Arise will become a model for transformative economic enterprise supporting the economic viability of Black communities and the wealth of their residents. Few things have been as destructive in our community as usurious payday loans with unconscionable interest rates. Now, here's just some statistics, something that I'll just briefly, quickly go over. The Financial Health Network's annual spend report in 2021 found that Blacks are nearly 4 times and Latinos 3 times more likely to take payday loans than white families. It also found that Black and Latino households spend a collective $101 billion on financial services study. Black households spent about 6% of their annual income on average. Latino households spent about 5%. And our white brothers and sisters spent around 3%. Exodus Lending, a nonprofit that references payday loans, refinances payday loans at 0% APR, found them, that would be 25 out of 33, to operate in qualified low-income census tracts across Minnesota. So these places are in low-income tract areas. And they tend to set up shop there. A 2016 Pew Research similarly found that an analysis of census tracts shows that blacks are twice as likely as Minnesotans as a whole to live within 2.5 miles of a payday loan store. The lenders are clearly and purposefully targeting low-income communities, predominantly made up of people of color, for their predatory services. Now, on both sides of the aisle, this is really affecting everyone. I mean, if we're doing okay, and that's fine, but we have a college student that's a relative. We have someone else that's not on the financial scale as we are. They could be taken advantage of by these loans. And on a personal note, yes, this is it does affect brown and black people a little bit more, but also it doesn't matter what color you are. You can be affected by this, but as much as it is about that, I think it's about a feeling. Minnesota is known to be the place, if you work hard and take care of your family, good things will happen. And if you need help, we're there with a helping hand. But at 400% interest, does that feel right? I mean, there's so many ways you can look at it. You need this. You need to have emergency funds. We understand that. But at 35% interest, I still believe that everyone can do well and the doors can stay open. But how does that feel? Does it feel right? And that's the question you'd have to ask yourself, not for your own personal, but the community at large. Thank you for your time, and it was my pleasure to speak in front of you all.
Thank you. I think that's the end of the author's testifiers. We did have one member of the public sign to testify, Paul Cassidy. Mr. Cassidy, if you could come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed your testimony. And as you're walking, I will say the same to you that I said to everyone else, that I'm not going to time you or limit you, but anything that you can do to try and leave time for questions, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Paul Cassidy. I'm with the Minneapolis law firm Stinson LLP. I'm here today to testify in opposition to House File 90 on behalf of our client, Payday America. Payday America is a state licensed and regulated provider of payday loans in the state of Minnesota, regulated by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The company employs almost 100 team members who provide services to thousands of Minnesota customers facing short-term credit needs every day. House File 290 would have the complete opposite effect of what supporters intend by eliminating access to short-term state-regulated consumer credit. In short, the legislation will force countless Minnesotans into the unregulated marketplace, including the internet, resulting in higher fees and little or no recourse through a regulator. Lenders simply will not do business in Minnesota under this rate cap. You might wonder who are payday customers. We alluded to that in previous testimony. Payday customers are middle-income Minnesotans. The majority earn between $25,000 and $50,000 a year. They are well educated, with 94% of them having a high school diploma and 56% having some college or other degree. They are young, 68% are under 45 years old. A majority are married, and 64% have children in their household. 42% own their homes, and 100% of them have steady incomes and checking accounts. Speaking of our customers, I'd like to play a short video where Payday America customers who cannot be here with us today share both why they use these loans and why they oppose the legislation.
You may play the video, that's fine.
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm from Lakeville, Minnesota. I am a Payday America customer for about 2 years now, and I am appealing to the Minnesota legislature on payday loans.
I'm Kevin. I live in Rosemont. I use the Payday America service that...
Hi, I'm Jessica. I'm from Lakeville, Minnesota. I am a Payday America customer for about 2 years now, and I am appealing to the Minnesota legislature on payday loans.
I'm Kevin. I live in Rosemont. I use the Payday America service that now the legislature wants to take that right away for me, myself, it helps me out a lot because sometimes I can't make it from payday to payday.
My name's Elizabeth. I'm from Burnsville, and I really appreciate that we have the ability to have payday loans.
Payday America belongs to the people. Without this one location, what do you do when you're in a pinch or when you need that help, when you need that loan?
My name is Allison. I'm from Burnsville, Minnesota, and I'm here on behalf of payday lenders. And I'd just like to say that this is a highly misguided thing to try to take away from us hardworking Minnesotans who, you know, need these services to survive.
My name is Nick. I'm a current resident here in Burnsville, Minnesota. I just wanted to personally speak to the legislation, just to let you guys know that I am fully aware of the loan percentages and everything that is paid here.
I totally understand, you know, that it's got to be back in a certain amount of time, like a 30-day loan, the interest rates, how the whole system works. And it works good for me because sometimes it's tough to make it from week to week.
Having a payday loan is a lot easier than trying to borrow money from family, having my electricity turned off and the fees that accompany that, bouncing a check, or not being able to put food on the table for my kids.
Today I'm here to take care of an emergency situation that I have been unable to rectify elsewhere.
My credit rating is not the best. Some banks won't give me a loan for, you know, to get a repair for a car or to even buy a car, whatever the case may be. And as long as you have a job here, they'll work with you and give you a loan.
We personally use payday loans in emergency situations. If we do not have the availability to use payday loans in emergency situations, we potentially run the risk of maybe getting a bill, a light shut off, electricity shut off, or even maybe losing a car due to a lack of a car payment.
What are you talking about, removing payday amount? Are you crazy? Huh? Where do you go when you need help? Oh, you don't need that help. You don't have to sit around gathering meetings and make legislation about, well, we should this and that. You already know what it affords to the community, the people. Everything we have is always taken away. You understand? That helps us financially. What else we got? You take this away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the video speaks for itself. Opponents of consumer short-term lending would like you to believe unsecured consumer loans have exorbitant fees, and this is simply not true. The average fee charged by Payday America, Minnesota's largest payday lender, on a $500 loan is less than 7% of the amount borrowed. The actual state-regulated cost of a $500 payday loan is $31.33 for a two-week term of the loan. That's right. It's $31 to borrow $500 for 2 weeks. Charges permitted under current Minnesota law governing short-term lenders pales when compared to the average cost of an overdraft fee, credit card late fee, utility reconnect fee, and merchant fees for bounce checks. Using that methodology, you can see that the APR and a lot of these other projects is multiples of what is charged by a payday lender for a two-week loan. As you saw in the video, Payday America's customers are satisfied with these products and services offered. They have a low default rate that's less than 1% going to collections. We're also unaware of any material complaints from consumers involving our loans that are regulated by the Minnesota Department of Commerce. The reality, Minnesota's regulated short-term consumer loan industry is a safe, reasonable, and responsible place for consumers seeking financial products. Putting us out of business or restricting customers' access to credit doesn't reduce the demand to address a short-term financial need. It simply creates an over $100 million hole in Minnesota's consumer credit market. Supporters of this legislation would also like you to believe there's no underwriting conducted with these loans, and therefore consumers are unable to repay them. Nothing could be further from the truth. Payday America does not make loans to customers unless they have verified and sustained income. Please respect the intelligent choices made by thousands of hardworking Minnesotans who in times of need rely on these products and services. And finally, I'll leave you with this one last question. Do you think it's reasonable and fair to charge someone $31 for the privilege of taking out a $500 loan for 2 weeks? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cassidy. We did have one other member of the public sign up to testify, Pat Kaiser from Catholic Chair from the Catholic Conference. Excuse me, Mr. Kaiser. Come forward, and as you've heard me say probably a couple times, to the extent you can limit your testimony, I appreciate it. Not going to time you.
While sitting there, I struck some words.
Love it.
Out of respect.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Chair Stevenson and committee members, my name is Pat Kaiser, and I am chair of the Minnesota Catholic Conference Social Concerns Committee. That's a mouthful. I also volunteer regularly at the St. Vincent de Paul Society Twin Cities, and I'm statewide coordinator for a St. Vincent de Paul program called Voice of the Poor. I come before you to express MCC's support for HF 290. Many Minnesota families are struggling and do live paycheck to paycheck. When these already strained families experience an unexpected expense, they may turn to payday lenders. However, the mere presence of a willing lender and a willing consumer does not necessarily make a good bargain, especially when the lender demands a triple-digit interest rate. MCC's policy positions are based on respect of the inherent human dignity of all people and pursuit of the common good. This, in conjunction with church teachings on economic justice, obligates us to question current payday lending practices, especially those that amount to modern-day usury. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is part of a broad coalition of faith-based entities that support payday lending reform in general and HF 290 specifically. Simply put, MCC and our partners believe that it is time to implement morally acceptable payday lending standards in Minnesota. The 36% interest rate cap outlined in HF 290 would allow lenders to earn fair and responsible profits. We urge you to take advantage of this opportunity to protect consumers and to restrain predatory lending. Please vote aye in favor of passage of HF 290. Thank you, Representative Cagle, for authoring this bill, and thank you, members, for your support of the people of Minnesota.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion and questions. Representative Dowd.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I really am sympathetic to the folks that are finding themselves in a little financial struggle. But this bill has been around for a long time. But this actually is a tool that those folks use to get by. And the testimony is compelling. $31 to access $500 of credit for 2 weeks. To me, it seems like a really reasonable amount. One check overdraft fee can be $30 or $35, and that check can be a $10 check. I mean, calculate the interest rate on that. I think that'd be 9,000%, right? A late payment on a credit card, a reconnection fee. I think there was a list of things that he went through. One access to one $500 short-term loan for 2 weeks could prevent somebody from having $500 in fees, in reconnection fees, and in bounce check fees or overdraft fees. I think about, and the thing that I don't like about this bill is it's picking on one industry. And I've noticed, I think we as legislators need to do a better job choosing our words. The predatory lending, I think about my bank. I have a notice set up on my checking account that notifies me of my daily balance. And it'll notify me if my balance goes below zero. It, however, will not, my bank will not notify me, even though they could do it instantly. It's just an email. If a check comes through and my account dips below zero, and you know that their term of business is 1 day, right? So if a check comes through at 9 a.m., I can go to the bank and make a deposit or make a transfer from my phone before 5 p.m., and I can prevent that fee. They will not notify me between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. They will only notify me at the end of business after they have charged me $35, right? And that can be on a $10 overdraft, right? You're picking on one industry here that actually does help people and prevents them from getting into that situation. I really applaud what the credit unions are doing and others. That's the answer to this problem. The answer to this problem isn't chasing folks who are actually helping people out of the state, and that's what will happen if we pass this bill. Look no further than states like Illinois, who now has passed something like this, and now folks who find themselves in a little pinch between paychecks and need a little help to prevent themselves from getting three overdrafts and a reconnect fee and a, you name it, credit card late fee that adds up to multiple times the $31 they would pay on a $500 loan. Now they don't have access to that. So we're actually putting them in a situation where they end up paying far more in fees. So I think we really need to think about, you know, and talk to the people from these communities that are accessing this that just need a little help, you know, like the folks in that video. I think it's, you know, my bank's in it to make money, right? They charge an interest rate. They charge a fee if my account goes below zero, right? But I thought it was funny. They will not notify me if my account goes below zero until after they have charged me the fee, right? By the way, that fee is more than I could borrow $500 from one of these organizations for a two-week period. So this would actually save me money. So I just would ask everybody to think about that. I know it seems there are certain groups that have been targeting this particular type of lending and using terms like predatory lending, but I'm glad that there were some customers that spoke up in these videos, because there are some other industries that would charge them fees if they didn't have access to this money that would be multiple times more. And if you want to put it into an interest rate, you can have a $10 overdraft at your bank and have a $35 overdraft fee. And I think if I did the math right, I think that's a 9,000% interest rate. Think about that, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. And this bill doesn't do anything to address that. In fact, this bill takes away a tool that could help somebody prevent that. And I think those are the sorts of things we should be looking for. We should be looking for the positive alternatives. You want to put the payday lending business out of business completely? I support that 100%. Do it in the right way, which is provide some other alternatives which give people access to money. This takes away access to money and will actually end up hurting people.
Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, Rep. Cagle. So a question on 3.3. So after the maturity of the loan on the remaining balance, we're saying that we can only charge 2.75% a month. That's less than the 36%. So why less of a percentage or less interest rate after maturity or when the loan, some might consider, is in default? Why not 3% there?
And Representative Farr, you're asking about lines 3.3 through 3.5, that the part that's existing law?
Correct.
Okay. Representative Cagle.
I'm 3 point of the amendment or
the DE. The DE.
I'm
yes.
Gonna phone the friend. 3 point. I might have older language then, because I have a person.
I think that we're looking at. I think Mr. Elwood, if you wanted to step down here, the question relates on the DE to page 3, line 3 through 5, and this is existing law in Minnesota. This is not a change in the bill that's being asked about. Mr. Elwood, if you could state your name for the record, then I don't know if you have an answer to Representative Farr's question.
Mr. Chair, members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. Representative Farr, you're questioning current law?
Representative Farr?
Well, I'm questioning line 3.3. And
right. I think the thing is that part of the DE2 is already in statute.
Okay. Then I'll drop the question.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Cagle. I have a question about the new evasion language, in particular on page 3, I think it's lines 26 through 29, where Mr. Cassidy had raised the concern that this is just going to force people into online markets that aren't regulated by the state of Minnesota, and I think this is new, you know, something that was kind of given to us maybe 2 hours before this hearing. but an attempt to deal with that. I'm just curious what the tools are that the state of Minnesota is going to have as after this in order to actually prevent this from happening and not just driving folks who do need some kind of temporary help into online marketplaces that the state of Minnesota doesn't have any ability to regulate at all.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Niska. This is actually making sure that we can enforce it. And so the no evasion language, again, is just kind of making sure that if it walks like a duck, talks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it's a duck. And so we want to make sure that, you know, we're not getting fronts up there that are, you know, pretending to be another business and then facilitating these loans. And so really just making sure that nobody's cheating.
Representative Niska.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cagle. I appreciate the fact that we're saying that something is illegal and is not going to be allowed. My question is more about turning that mandate or statement into actual on the ground reality. So what are the tools that the state will have as a result of this to, I mean, we're not going to shut off the internet or block certain websites, I'm guessing. So what are the tools that the state is going to have that are going to prevent this bill from just becoming the, you know, conduit to force folks in need into those kind of websites?
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Niska. I think if you go to so Section 8, that gives us the penalties for violation, private right of action, and allows for people to so that's the enforcement mechanism there.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Cagle. Where is Section 8? That's in the existing consumer small loan stat. Again, this is, and Mr. Chair, I appreciate that, you know, you say that this bill is not, I mean, this bill turned from, went from a five-page bill to a nine-page bill 2 hours before the hearing, and so.
Though, Representative Niska, the section you're referring to was in the original bill. The penalties.
The section I was asking.
The penalties section.
Right.
You're asking about how it
right.
was affected.
I'm trying to understand how these things fit together that yeah. we got 2 hours before the hearing. So thank you for your patience. But can you just help me understand where 47.6.601 is adding in 5A, which is not subdivision 8.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Elwood. Go ahead, Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Niska, I think I can help clarify your question. Section 8 is current law. We've had several these laws. 47660 is the original payday lending law. 47601 was a statute that was put in 2009 to address some of the loopholes that had arisen under the original law to sweep in people. Basically, if you're, if you walk like a duck and you quack like a duck, you're a duck. If you make a payday loan, you ought to be regulated by the same statutes. So in 2009, the section you're referring to was put into law to make sure that if anybody was lending at rates above allowable rates or were lending in an unlicensed manner, there was a remedy. Not only is there a private remedy here, but the Attorney General also has authority. It's not in this amendment. It's in current law. And I can tell you that in terms of the Internet, the Attorney General, several Attorney Generals have been aggressive in going after violators. And the last thing I would say about the Internet is that the Pew Charitable Trusts did an extensive and multiple series study on payday loans, and they have found that in the states that have done what Representative Cagle's bill is intending to do, borrowers do not go to the Internet anymore. And the last thing is, there are more internet loans currently in Minnesota and across the country than are at storefront loans. And some of the payday lenders in Minnesota operate online operations as well. So I think the internet argument is specious, and it really is it's a non-issue.
Representative Niska?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll take your word for it on the effect of the internet thing. I do think we're probably going to need at least another amendment before this goes to floor, because Subdivision 6, Section 8, which amends Subdivision 6 of 47.601, adds a reference to Subdivision 5A, but it does not add a reference to Subdivision 8, which is the no evasion provision. So those two things need to be tied together, and they aren't currently tied together in the way that this is drafted, at least from what I can see. And again, I wish that the majority was proceeding with things like this in a little bit of a different matter.
Representative Niska, I think Ms. Pompeo has some information that may allay your concern. Okay. Ms. Pompeo?
Thank you, Chair and members. There's a cross-reference in current law. I know it's very confusing, but there's another cross-reference so that Subdivision 8 is covered by these penalties as well. It's just an existing law that isn't reprinted here.
Okay. I'll take your word for it again on that.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that there's one more bill ahead of us here today. I'll just wrap for our time.
Can I just say that we Please. Can go over a little bit today?
Understood.
We have to devote time to get to this through this bill. We will do that.
And thank you.
We will hold the other bill.
Thank you.
But anyway, continue.
Thank you. So I want to just kind of summarize a little bit. I don't think that we on this side of the aisle want to see people being extorted. That's the last thing that we want to have happen. What we are concerned about is the unintended consequences of this legislation. And if you take a look at where people can borrow money, you can go to a bank, you can borrow money. Credit unions are put into place to be able to help communities and to help individuals within the community. As a matter of fact, they're given preferential tax treatment in the state of Minnesota and across the country for that purpose of trying to lift up and to help individuals. Those industries are regulated by state and federal regulators on guidelines for loans and income verifications and all of what we call underwriting in the industry. If you're looking for money and you can't get it at a bank, and you can't get it at a credit union, now you're looking for another source to be able to get money, to be able to take care of a need that's very important to you, to your family, to your loved ones. And we don't always know what people are using that money for. It might be to buy prescriptions. We don't know. And it seems to me that if we go in and we limit this option, which a lot of people have angst over, we push that group of people into a less desirable location to be able to borrow money. I heard the term used today, and they are spot on in testimony, loan sharks. If you think about a loan shark, and you think about the movies you saw on television that were in the 1930s and the 1940s about somebody coming and busting your kneecaps, that's where we start pushing people if we don't have it on a regulated basis like this. But Representative O'Driscoll, Representative Kegel's bill puts regulations on that. Here's what I've observed in the central Minnesota area where I hail from. Pawn shops, that's another place where you can get money. Bring something of value, you pawn that, you get money. They are closing in the central Minnesota area, and I suspect they are closing across the state. Do you know what other service those businesses offer? Payday loans. When the pawn shop closes and you can't take something of value, get money to meet your needs, or get a payday loan there, these options are shrinking. What happens if these current providers, because of regulation like this, say, you know what, it's not worth it for us to be in the marketplace anymore? Where are we putting people? Where are we moving these people to? And the chair is exactly right when he says we've heard this bill several times in this committee, but I've never heard a solution when this question that I just raised has been raised. It's let's move the bill. The bill fixes everything. It does not. It just moves the ball for some of the most vulnerable people in our population. And that bothers me. And I hope that bothers you too. We heard about extortion, taking advantage of people. I somehow think that people who are regulated by regulators are going to be a little bit more cautious than people who are unregulated. We have to go and borrow money from people that you don't know under terms and conditions of repayment that you don't know. And, you know, borrowing from family, that's a humility thing for a lot of people. I don't know. This just does not seem like this solves the problem. It actually can create additional problems. And the fact that this can be done on the internet, which is an interstate commerce-related thing, we could be pushing people out to virtually unknown people out there. Now, Representative Kegel and Mr. Elwood have represented in the bill that there are safeguards on here. But remember, it's not an intranet in the state of Minnesota. It's an internet across not only the United States, but across the world. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Fiscal. We do have a couple of BFL members who have quick comments. I pushed to the end of the line to make sure we got enough time for all of the Republican members. Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cagle, thank you for bringing the bill forward. The things that I heard today that are so disturbing to me is that I do not want the Minnesota legislature to be a place where we say people who are in desperate situations are open to extortion. And I think that's a message we never want to send to Minnesotans. 36%, if you cannot work your business with a 36% profit, maybe you don't really have a business. And we should not be legalizing robbery. I'll just say that. Now, the solution, since we were asked if we had any solutions, I would say that if we have financial institutions that are taking state tax dollars in the form of tax credits, maybe we should say that they should be offering low interest or no interest loans at that same value. It is a partnership that we have between state and private entities that allow our economy to grow. So there are places where we could introduce legislation that could get rid of this problem, but I do think calling it out in a public way like this is critical. So thank you so much for bringing the bill forward.
Representative Katisa Batun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few points that I'd like to make today. First of all, Representative Dowd, sounds like we could maybe do some future work together on financial regulations, so I like that. And I just want to also say that we're not pushing Payday America out of Minnesota. We are working to enforce a fairer interest rate for consumers. And it seems like the folks in that video were potentially misled a little bit. And so I'm really appreciative that there is a section in this bill now on evasion and how that's not allowed. Whether that was intentional or not, I don't know. But I also wanted to just double check on this section of evasion, because it has seeming like the majority party is being accused of moving a piece of legislation too quickly, bringing changes to this bill 2 hours before the hearing, going from 5 pages to 9 pages. There's one paragraph on the 9th page. So I think that that's pretty much 8 pages. And then this section four, no evasion, and also section 7 is no evasion. While they implement two different pieces of current state statute, 47.60 and 47.61, the language looks identical to me. Is that accurate, Representative Cagle? Is there any changes between the two sections on no evasion in this language? Okay, they're the same.
Representative Cagle's nodding, yep.
Okay, sorry. Thank you. So that's two more pages that got added, because that's a very long section, and that's it. So there's essentially one page outside of the evasion section that we had to consider over the last 2 hours, and Representative Cagle did a great presentation. Her testifiers did a great job. I appreciate House Research's comments on current statute and cross-references. I think that the discussion today has been very helpful. And I think that our minority members might be really excited to hear about a bill that I'm working on with Exodus Lending to kind of fill the gap here for folks. So I'm looking forward to bringing that to the committee soon. And I think that everybody should be supporting this so that we can take care of Minnesotans.
Representative Dow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Representative Cleburne's comment about the interest rate of 36%, that a business should be able to operate on a 36%, that's not how this works. 36% of a $500 loan is $180. I just did the math on my calculator. But we took testimony today that for a two-week loan, the fees and interest were $31 on a $500 loan. So we need not misrepresent the situation. And the reality is, if we try to put this into a situation where we're defining it by an annual percentage rate for a two-week loan, a 36% interest rate, I'm just back of napkin, for borrowing $500 is going to be like $7. There isn't anybody in the world that's going to borrow $500 for $7 in return, right? So, and $7 might be too much. And if there are, then they should run their business in this state, borrow the money, and everybody will use them, right? But the reality is, why take away an option that people are using so that they don't have to pay a 9,000% interest rate at their bank when they have an overdraft fee on a $10 overdraft to access $500 for 31? This isn't a situation where somebody's operating a business at a 36% margin. I agree with you. I don't think, you know, and they're not operating at a 36% margin. You know, you can simply do the math on $31 is the testimony that we took today for a $500 loan. So unfortunately, this is a bill that sounds really great, but does not solve the problem. It will actually create more problems for the people that are using this short-term loan as a bridge to prevent themselves from having to pay a whole bunch of other fees on other stuff, right? And it does happen. I have been there in my life. After college, I probably wasn't the best money manager. And I had an overdraft here or there. But today, I could probably sign my name and borrow $100,000, right? Not everybody can do that. So let's not take away this option that can help somebody in a short-term situation get by without having to pay a bunch of fees on some other stuff. $500 could help. I mean, you could have 3, 4, 5. You could have a dozen overdrafts hit your checking account and get $35 per transaction on your checking account. I'm not going to continue to just calculate the interest rates on that, but it's not right to say interest rate, and that's why it's not right to put the interest rate into statute, right? I think you have to ask yourself, is $31 too much money to pay for a two-week loan on a $500 note? I actually would pay that if I needed $500. I think that's a reasonable amount. I don't think it's reasonable to pay a $35 overdraft, which it actually is, because that's the rules I signed up for in my checking account. If I have an overdraft fee of $10, it's a $35 fee. But this bill doesn't address that. This bill actually takes away a tool that would prevent somebody from getting stuck in that situation. So I have seen the majority party get really pigeonholed into hating this industry and using terms like predatory lending, but the actual consumer complaints and material complaints are nil on this industry. So we've taken that testimony again today. So I just hate when the legislature is going after one industry. That's not our job, but our job is to protect Minnesotans. But you will expose Minnesotans to greater risk and greater fees and greater turmoil by taking away this regulated tool from them.
Thank you, Representative Dow. Representative Cagle, any brief closing comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to kind of respond, 6 out of 10 largest banks in terms of branches are actually now offering these small dollar loan programs. And so I think Wells Fargo has their Flex loan. And so Huntington Bank has a $100 to $1,000 loan for 12% APR. Also, the predatory lending language actually is something that the Department of Defense classified this kind of lending as. And so with that, I just want to thank you all for the robust discussion, and please support House File 290.
All right. Representative Cagle renews her motion that House File 290, as amended, be placed on the recommended be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 290, as amended, is recommended to be placed on the general register. And Representative Petersburg has been sitting here for a while. We do have the room for another 10 minutes. And I'm looking over at Representative O'Driscoll because I think this is an uncontroversial bill. There's no one who signed to testify. Without objection, I'd like to give them the chance to do it.
As you wish, Mr. Chair.
We're going to try and do this. Representative Petersburg, welcome to the committee. I'm sorry you had to wait. I appreciate your patience. I will move House File 581 be recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I believe this is certainly a lot simpler than the last two bills that you've dealt with. This is simply a clarification, a grammatical clarification, to make it clear on the intent of the bill. Just briefly, the background is that prior to last year, Minnesota was the end result or was the ending destination for a lot of vehicles and trucks that had a lot of damage to them that came with clean titles, and there was no disclosure to the consumer when they're buying them. And our bill went through a lot of discussion in a conference committee, came out with this bill, and this simply clarifies the fact that, and I'm going to read it how it will be with the new change. A dealer must provide a written disclosure and, except for sales performed online, an oral disclosure of the events that have occurred to that particular one. It was unclear prior to that whether or not this applied to online as well, and so this just clarifies that piece. It's simple, straightforward. I have support from both legal aid as well as I've talked to dealers as well, their representative, and this seems to be all good. So appreciate that.
I agree. It was a good catch. Anyone in the public wishing to testify to this bill? No one signed up in advance. Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Any discussion or questions to the bill? Seeing none, any closing comment, Representative Petersburg?
Just thank you for hearing this, and thank you for addressing this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll renew the motion that House File 581 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 581 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Representative O'Driscoll.
It's that time in committee. Do we have a roadmap for next week, sir?
Yeah, so on Monday, we will be having a hearing relating to the proposed combination between Fairview Health Systems and Sanford. It will be an informational-style hearing. We will not take action on any bills on Monday. On Wednesday, we will take action on bill potentially not yet determined, but I will get.
I said you and I will consult?
We will consult, yes.
Very good, thank you.
No further items on the agenda. The committee is adjourned.